Good to be with you this morning. Glad to give Jonathan a Sunday where he didn't have to prepare. He's had more than enough to prepare for this week. If you didn't know, Jonathan was ordained this week and went through examination. And having done that, we commiserated with each other about what that's like. I don't know if you understand that totally. I don't know if he's talked to you about it, but we're talking 2.5-3 hours of questioning everything from what is a particular book of the Bible's outline and theme, chapter content. You could go to any chapter of the Bible, to any question theologically. How many of you guys heard that question about superlapsarianism being hyper-Calvinist or Calvinistic on Sunday night? Did you hear that question that Rory asked? Yeah. Okay, so questions like that are totally valid. He's supposed to know what all those words mean. And then also practical questions like, what do you do with a teenager who's in your youth? No, I'm just kidding. But practical questions. Practical questions about ministry. So 2.5 hours of that, it's a pretty tiring thing. And Jonathan passed that with flying colors because he's prepared well. I don't need to tell you that. You guys get to benefit from his preparation every single week. So I'm honored to come and enjoy this time with you today. I do have three bullet marks on my left side that prove that I was indeed there yesterday. And I showed them to my wife last night with great pride and honor, but she didn't seem to find the same enjoyment in them that I did. So, you know, I said, babe, I've been to the battle and I've returned, and she didn't really grasp the whole weight of that. I mean, to me, we were in Nam yesterday, okay? We were in Nam, we were in the jungles, and we had to get out of there alive, and I was willing to die for my comrades. It was a We Were Soldiers moment, I'm telling you. I'm not kidding. There was a photographer. I threw him a gun. I said, get in the battle, kid. It's time to fight. So, I'm teasing. No, I totally enjoyed that. I mean, I totally love paintball, and I was proud father. Yesterday, adopted father of Wendell and Robert. And so we went into battle together, and we all came home alive, so that was great. And, yeah, it was totally fun. But I am getting older, and like now whenever I do anything that's strenuous for any amount of time, weird parts of me hurt the next day. So like just random parts. It's not unified. It's not like my legs hurt in general. It's just like one part of one leg really hurts for some reason. And I don't know if that muscle hasn't been worked out for longer than the other ones, but my left quadricep is very painful this morning, and I don't know what it'll have in effect of this sermon, but I'm having a hard time moving to my left, and my left hip is killing me because I kept sliding into things because I want to have my gun up and make sure that I was doing everything I should do. All right, my wife, Renee, I totally wish she was here. She wishes she was here as well. I was playing paintball. She was throwing up, so that was kind of the... Maybe that's why she wasn't so thrilled about my my events yesterday. But, yeah, we have a little baby coming in April. And I don't know that this is baby-related, but she's got a little bug or something, so she's not feeling well. She's under the weather this morning, and she was apologizing to me for not being here. But she would have liked to have been with you all. So her name is Renee. I think you've all seen her or met her. She's tall, really curly hair. And in my estimation, the hottest thing going on this campus, all right? So I might as well just get that out there right here, right now. There's really no argument in my book, but I'm sure you guys may have a different opinion. All right? I want to talk this morning. You guys know where we are, right? Okay, last week you did Judges, so if you have had any awareness of what's been going on in these weekly surveys, you were able to come to the conclusion that this week we're going to talk about Ruth. But before we get to Ruth, I want to think with you, and I don't know if you think like this. I do occasionally, probably not as much as I should. But have you ever thought about the amazing, the millions and millions of decisions and events that have made it so that you're sitting where you're sitting, and I'm standing where I'm standing, and we're actually interacting with each other this morning? You think about how bizarre that is? I mean, have you ever thought? I'm from Ohio, and I finished high school in Pennsylvania. I went to school in South Carolina. I went to grad school in California. And somehow, I'm standing in Texas in front of you. And you know my name, and I know some of your names. Isn't that crazy? I mean, you ever thought about how many decisions that went into that? And how random that seems? That from our backgrounds, with our parents, and where they chose to live, and who they chose to hang out with, and the jobs that the Lord gave our fathers, or whatever the case may be, all of us have, through very different ways, different avenues, come to this morning, and we're sitting here together. Now, as believers, we understand that theologically. Okay, that's not random. We don't think of that as fate or as some random act. That's just the way things happened. We understand that God directed our steps, and He brought us here, and He knew that we were going to be here this morning. He knew that you'd be sitting in the chair you're sitting in with your scriptures open. He knew what would be on your mind right now, how your heart would be burdened. He's known it for all of time. He knew that I would be standing here, that this would be the text that we would study. And He designed and worked out every decision that needed to be made so that that would happen. And there's a theological name when God orchestrates events. Who knows what that's called? There's a couple names that may come up, but who knows what word we use theologically to explain God orchestrating our events. Okay, that's one idea, predestination. That would be the concept of God knowing ahead of time and choosing ahead of time what would happen. There's another word, starts with a P. Probably is it a little more along the lines of God orchestrating the events. Providence. Yeah, that's right. So you have the sovereignty of God, and you have all the words associated with God's sovereignty. But the particular working out of decisions and events in accordance with His will is called God's providence. And providence is a miracle. It's amazing. It's beyond our mind. When you think, just think about the friends that you hang out with and the providence that God orchestrated to bring you to know that friend. I mean, how many random things could have happened before you met the friend that would have changed forever? If you, and I hope many of you, some of you I'm looking at, I'm thinking it's a little less than 50-50, but I hope many of you are married at some point in the future. If you're ever married, mainly guys that are 50-50, if you're married, it'll be amazing to sit and think about these two lives that God raised up and put together to become one flesh and covenant together and live their lives together. It's a miracle. It's beyond our thinking. And if you haven't been meditating on that reality, and I don't think we do a lot because generally we just go through the day. We pick what we're going to eat, pick what we're going to wear, and we don't put a lot of thought into it. But if you're not meditating on the providence of God and how He is orchestrating His will through you, and He's bringing about His ends in your life and everyone else around you, whether they're struggles or whether they're blessings, God is doing what He desires to do through providence. I trust the book of Ruth will be a reminder and an encouragement to you this morning. The only response to reading the book of Ruth is to sit back in awe and really to worship our God for His providence and the way that He orchestrates and plays out His plan here on earth. All right, this book is, let's just do a little introductory stuff on the book of Ruth. It's not long, which makes it super cool. I read it this morning when it was 5-something in the morning, and I thought, okay, my brain is as foggy as it can be, so I'm going to try to read and concentrate, and I know my reading will be very slow and methodical, and I read it in 18 minutes. So, and I'm no speed reader, trust me. That was every word. My little eyes going over every single word. 18 minutes. You can read the book of Ruth with comprehension. So it's a book that you can take and you can meditate on it in one morning and spend your entire morning on this particular book. And I would encourage you to do that. I've been doing that for a couple weeks, just meditating on the truths that are found here in the book of Ruth. So it's a small book. The author is unknown. If you're taking notes and you want to know about the author, if you have a study Bible, it may mention Samuel. The Jewish Talmud, which is their book of tradition and interpretation of the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, credits this book to Samuel. But if you read through the book, you'll not find any evidence from inside this particular book that Samuel wrote it. And nor will you find any evidence of anybody else. So the tradition is Samuel wrote it. We do know that it was written in a time period right before or during the beginning of David's reign. Say, now how do we know that? We know that because the genealogy at the end of this book ends with David, but it doesn't give us Solomon. Okay? So the genealogy of the kingly line only went up to David at the point it was written. There was no Solomon yet, which means there was no Bathsheba yet. So we're back in the earlier stages or right before David is brought into his kingship. So if you want a date on that, that would be somewhere between 1011 and 971 BC. And I'm sure you're going to write that down because that's an important piece of historical information. The key is to understand it's written in David's time, which makes Samuel a viable author. Okay, because Samuel was contemporary with David. Theological theme is the divine providence of God. Let me give you a little outline for this book. All right, if you're going to study the book and you're going to read through it, let me just give you a basic. This is just a basic outline. This will not be what we'll study this morning, but it's a basic outline, a structure to the book. In chapter 1, verses 1 to 5, you have an introduction to the book. So you have just an introduction. Number 1, an introduction. Number 2, you have Naomi and Ruth return to Bethlehem in the rest of chapter 1. So that's 1, 6 to 22. Number 3, Ruth gleans from the fields of Boaz. And that's in chapter 2, verses 1 to 23. Number 4, that was Ruth gleans with Boaz, number 3. Number 4, Ruth requests Boaz as a redeemer. And that's in chapter 3, verses 1 to 18. Ruth requests Boaz as redeemer. Number 5, Boaz redeems Ruth and the land of Naomi. And that's in chapter 4, verses 1 to 12. Boaz redeems Ruth and the land. Number 6, Ruth births a son, or gives birth to a son. Why I made birth a verb, I'm not exactly sure. But Ruth births a son. Okay, gives birth to a son. And that's chapter 4, verses 13 to 15. And then lastly, it concludes with the genealogy that flows out of Boaz and Ruth's marriage, the genealogy of David. And that's in chapter 4, verses 16 to 22. Okay, that gives you just a general overview. I have read all week and last week reviews and commentaries on the book of Ruth. This is considered to be one of the masterpieces of literature in the scriptures, really as a short story. I don't know if you guys read short stories. Let me just make a little personal confession here. I really like one particular author of short stories. I don't know why I'm sharing this with you, but his name is Louis L'Amour. Everybody ever heard of Louis L'Amour? Yes, because I like cowboys and Indians. So I got that out. It's off my chest. Louis L'Amour writes short stories, and they're cowboy western stories. You know, they're all the same. Ultimately, the good guy wins, shoots all the bad guys, and gets the girl, okay? You don't need to read them. That's it. That's what's going to happen. Different scenarios, different names, same end to the whole thing. Good guy wins, gets the girl, okay? I actually love those stories. This is a short story, and literature-wise, this is a masterpiece of a short story with detail and with timing and the way it's written. So whoever wrote this, whether it be Samuel or another author that God chose to inspire, he did so with great skill in literature. It's also could be understood as the Hallmark book of the Bible, right? How many of you ever seen a Hallmark movie? It's the same storyline as the Louis L'Amour books. But the good guy wins and always gets the girl. And Hallmark movies are warm and sappy. And guys, you will have to watch them when you get married at some point. And so hold out as long as possible. Don't waste and watch one now. You'll have to watch one later. Ruth is a love story. And I don't want to detract from that. It's a beautiful love story. But there is a lot more than just affection for a man and a woman to be found in the book of Ruth. And if we limit the book of Ruth to just being a love story, then we are in danger of missing the bigger picture, which is God's providence and his plan being played out in the lives of these characters that we see in the book of Ruth. All right? The narrative, the story is powerful. The theology behind it is powerful. And I think combined, they make a powerful message for you and I today. This book is important whether you're in high school whether you're a child and you hear this in Sunday school, or whether you're an adult or a senior saint, this story is important because it testifies to the fact that God always accomplishes what He intends to accomplish. And He uses you and I to do that end. And that is an amazing truth that is reinforced in the book of Ruth. Now, obviously, we are not going to read the book of Ruth. I know you were hoping that when you heard the 18-minute thing. You're like, sweet, if we just read this and then we end, we're done in 18 minutes. But that's not what we're going to do, okay? Hang on, we've got like 2 more hours left, all right? And then we're going to be done. We're going to just take a cursory overview. That's the idea of this as a survey. And I want to take just a little bit of time and work through three key aspects of God's providence that we find in the book of Ruth, okay? Three key aspects of God's providence. These will be your actual outline to what we've studied today. And I just want you to look at God's providence. That's what I want to think about. Look at how God orchestrates what He does. So in chapter 1, we're going to look at the providence of God in suffering. The book of Ruth begins with an amazing famine happening in the land of Israel, in Bethlehem. Elimelech, there's all kinds of cool names in this too that I'm sure I will not get right, but Elimelech takes his family, and in defiance of God's covenant, here we are in the time of the judges. So what we talked about, what you all talked about last week, we're still in that time period. It's not a good time in Israel. There's no leader who's established. God is using judges to continue His covenant with His people, but it's not a good time. And famine comes, whether it be God's judgment or whether it be an invasion from outside, but famine happens. And famine is something we can't comprehend. No food. The potential of dying off one by one, weakest to strongest. So Elimelech takes his family and he leaves the promised land and he goes to a Gentile nation. He goes to the land of Moab. Okay? Very good. Goes to Moab. Gets to Moab. He has these 2 sons. They marry 2 gals from Moab. And in sequence, Elimelech dies, leaving Naomi there with her 2 sons and daughter-in-laws. And then, quickly thereafter, her 2 sons die. And so you have a mother-in-law and her 2 daughters-in-law. And they are she is in a foreign land, which is their home country. And this is where we begin the story of Ruth. Now, Ruth's sister-in-law, who was married to Naomi's other son, has the gorgeous name of Orpah. All right? I know like odd and cool names are kind of in right now, but Orpah is not one of them. All right? No, we don't do Orpah. All right? Orpah is not game for naming your daughter. All right? But Orpah is there with Ruth, and Naomi, in normal cultural sense, says to them, "Go back. I'm leaving. I'm going to go back to Israel because I have nobody here to care for me." Now, in the book of James, we have true and undefiled religion is the caring for orphans and widows. Right. Because in this time and all the way through the New Testament period, orphans and widows had no way of providing for themselves. Okay? Women were not out working. There weren't business women. There was no such thing as an Israelite business suit for a woman. Okay? There wasn't anything like that. And so what happened was, is as family members died, widows, if their husband died, were left to the care of their sons. And their son would take in their mom and care for her, provide for her every need. And obviously, in this story, Naomi is left without any resource. So she has these 2 daughters-in-law who have families who can provide for them. She says, "Go back to your families. I'm going back to my family, any relative I can find who's a man in Israel who can provide for my needs. And you go back to yours and stay here in your homeland of Moab." We know that Orpah decides, yes, I'm going to stay. She weeps, she cries, she kisses her, she hugs her, and then she goes back to her family. Ruth does something else. Ruth makes a statement that we use as a common idiom in our language. Actually, unsaved people, those who don't read the Bible, remember this comment from Ruth that we find starting in verse 15 of chapter 1. Here's Orpah and Ruth, and they lifted up their voices and wept again in verse 14, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, this is Naomi, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. And verse 16, but Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Here it is. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything, but death part you and me. And you've heard this. Your people are my people. So here is Naomi trying to send back in her suffering. She's lost everything. She has no resource, no provision. And the question that must be sitting in Naomi's mind, just like in your minds, when difficult times come, when trials come, when you lose a loved one, when you're around death, especially the death of the young with her two sons, the question is, why? Why has God done this? Why has He allowed them to die? Why am I left without resource? Why has God, as she'll say later, dealt bitterly with me? And here Naomi, for sure, is asking the question of God, why has this happened? And in the moment of her grief, and in the moment of her suffering and destitution, Ruth says, I'm staying with you, and we'll go forward. So we see God's providence in death. He's in control. Whether you know it or not at this point, whether Naomi knows it or not at this point, God is working out a master plan. His providence is in death, His providence is in family decisions, and His providence is seen in their safe return to Bethlehem. Now, point number one is the providence of God in suffering seen throughout chapter one. Let me just take a minute and apply that to your lives, okay? Every family decision, it's a part of your existence. Okay, let's make it real practical. Your parents are God's design for you. Every authority in your life is God's design and His providence for you. It's not by accident. I mean, sometimes we think, man, if I had that set of parents, life would be so much different. God has chosen to give you the authority in your life that He's given you. And each of our parents are different. And yet God has perfectly chosen them, even when they make poor decisions, or when they are difficult, or when suffering and trial comes to our family. God is working out His plan through His divine providence in your life. You may be asking this morning the question, why? Why is this what I got stuck with? Why is this the scenario that I'm in? And let me just assure you, as I would have assured Naomi, and as ultimately God will comfort you with this morning from the book of Ruth, God is at work through your life circumstances. You didn't pick them. He did. And He did it for a good reason. All right? Secondly, today, providence of God in provision. Second half of the book, the providence of God in provision. And this is where our good man Boaz comes into the picture, okay? Naomi and Ruth get back. Naomi tells the women of the city, amazing thing, you gals that are concerned about the way you look this morning, think about this, okay? Verse 19. This is tough day at the office for Naomi. Okay, verse 19, so they both went until they came to Bethlehem, and when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them, and the women, that's the women of the city, all right? Is that Naomi? As in, we don't recognize her anymore. As in, the years have been hard on Naomi. She doesn't look good. Is that Naomi? And Naomi's response is, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. In other words, give me another name, because God has been so bitter in His workings towards me. My life has been so hard in God's providence. I went out full, verse 21, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? difficult times. They come back, and here chapter 2, verse 1, starts out the second portion of the book, and it gives us this heading. Now Naomi, the author gives us this insight. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. All right? Now that's the narrator talking to you. He's telling you, FYI, here in Bethlehem, there's a guy named Boaz, and he's a relative of Naomi. So that's important when you're reading this book, because you're going to find out that in the future, Naomi is thinking, well, who did you get all this food from? And then Ruth will disclose how God brought her to provision. The providence of God in provision is seen in chapter 2 and chapter 3. Now, verse 2 of chapter 2 says, "And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Please let me go to the field and glean from among the ears of grain after one in those whose sight I might find favor.' And she said to her, 'Go, my daughter.' So she departed and went," verse 3, "and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech." All right, so basically, this is your common day labor of that time. It was harvest season, so those who were widowed could go out, follow behind, you've heard this, I know you have, okay? You follow behind the reapers who would be cutting down the grain, bundling it into bundles, and loading it then onto carts of some type to carry it to the threshing floor. Women, the destitute, the widows, could come behind them, and anything that happened to fall out while they were bundling it, or happened not to get cut off and fall over, they could pick that up and take it with them. And so they could get as much as they could scrape out on these different fields and any number of reapers. But they were seen as the lowest of the low. And here, Ruth happens to come to the field of Boaz. And I like this when we get to this part because I confess, I relate a little bit with Boaz, okay? He says here, "Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. He said to the reapers, 'May the Lord be with you.' And they said to him, 'May the Lord be with you or bless you.' Then Boaz said to his servants who were in charge of the reapers, 'Who is that fine-looking girl over there?'" All right? That's what Boaz said. That's the English translation we should have. He says, "Whose girl is that? Is that gal attached to somebody, to a family? Is she married? Whose woman is that?" And obviously, we have the first spark of interest from our good man Boaz. All right? And the servant in charge of the reapers in verse 6 of chapter 2 replied, "She's the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab." And this was a well-known story. And so Boaz goes to her and he says, "I want you to stay in my field because I'm related to Elimelech and I know about you. I know what you've done with your mother-in-law, and I appreciate what God has done in you. So I'm going to give you bountifully. My servants will watch over you, and you'll not be harmed. Stay in my field." All right? This is getting good. Or it's getting slightly uncomfortable. Okay? So God has provided in His providence food in abundance. All right? You remember now. Ruth goes out, she's expecting to get some scraps. She comes home with like grocery carts full of wheat. And Naomi sees her coming and is going, "You got to be kidding me. Where did you go? That's a sloppy group of workers in that field if you clean this much." Okay? And she tells her, of course, that she has been with Boaz. And Naomi says to her daughter, "This is a good thing because he is a relative of ours." Now, notice, there was no ignorance. If you're reading through this and you're reading about the kinsman redeemer, Naomi does not say to Ruth, "This guy can redeem you." He says, "This is a close relative of our family. He is a redeemer of our family, but he is not the near redeemer." So in the pecking order of coming back home to nothing, no husband, no sons, we would move next to the closest relative to your husband, and he would be responsible to provide for his brother's family. So in our world, in our sense, if your mom and you lost your father and none of you were old enough to provide, you would go under your uncle's watch care and your uncle would provide for your needs. And if your uncle wasn't there, then we would move on to one step further removed. Maybe a cousin. So that's the concept here. So Boaz is not the nearest, but he is, in fact, a kinsman redeemer. All right? So God is now providing, in his providence, he is providing food, and ultimately he is providing for marriage for Ruth. All right, we move to chapter 3, continuing on the same theme. Naomi says to Ruth, my daughter, verse 1, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Now, don't get the wrong impression about this. I don't think Naomi is a busybody or a matchmaker. All right? I don't think Naomi is in her little mud house with a lot of grain. All right? I don't think she's standing there going, ooh, this is coming together nicely. Right? I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think Naomi is burdened with the fact that she has lost everything. She's brought a daughter-in-law back who also doesn't have any provision. And maybe God is working to provide for this daughter-in-law. And so she says, wait a second, isn't Boaz a kinsman for us? She says in verse 3, go get dudeed up, get everything on that you need to get on, get your makeup on, get your hair looking good, wash yourself, put your perfume on, and head on over to Boaz's place because Boaz is going to be on the threshing floor tonight. So, long story short, Boaz is there, he's working, he eats, he drinks, his heart is at ease, says his heart is merry, it doesn't mean he's drunk necessarily, even though when you read that, that's what you think. Okay? But it's not. There are tons of contexts in Scripture where that phrase does not mean he's drunk. He eats, he drinks, he's happy, and he rests there. In the odd culture that we cannot totally relate to. When a girl like passes us a note or something and says, like, you know, I like you, you like me, you know, kind of thing, please check yes or no. Yeah. Okay, we can relate to that, all right? But what's about to happen here? In God's providence, we can't relate to. Because she gets everything on that she can get on. Here's this nasty, sweaty guy who's been working all day. He lays down on a pile of wheat, all right? And he throws his big old cloak blanket over him, and he just goes to sleep. She comes in after dark. It's totally late. She knows he's there. She takes the blanket, and she uncovers his feet. And then lays down at this guy's feet. Now think about feet in the Middle East, all right? Think about that. I mean, there weren't shoes. They wore sandals. It was gross. She lays down at his feet. And he's startled awake in the middle of the night, maybe because of how cold he gets from his knees down. Wakes up, and to his alarm, there's a lady obviously laying at his feet, all right? Now think about this. Just try to picture this. This is beyond our thinking, right? Wakes up, he's startled, and she says, you are a potential redeemer for me. And she makes her intentions clear. There's no impropriety here. I don't think there's any evidence from the text that there was any immorality, if there was anything inappropriate about what was going on. In fact, to do so would be to completely ruin Ruth's credibility and Boaz's credibility, and in fact, demolish the beauty of this story. And so here they are in purity. He says, leave before it's light, because we don't want there to be an appearance of immorality on our part. But he tells her the bad news in chapter 3. There's another guy who's a closer redeemer, all right? This is where it gets even more interesting because we move further away from our mental concept of what's happening. God, in his providence, has provided in suffering, in his providence, in provision for food and marriage. And then lastly, God's providence is seen in redemption. The providence of God in redemption. Chapter 4, we see God's providence in redemption. Boaz goes to the town gates, sits down, waits till the nearest redeemer, The brother or cousin that's closer comes by. He says, hey man, you're the nearest redeemer to Naomi. She's got a field. You're going to need to buy it because she needs provision. So you're going to buy the field. The guy says, yeah, I'll buy the field. Not a problem. He's like, oh yeah, catch. If you buy the field, you need to take Ruth too, and she needs to be your wife. And he says, I can't do that. If I do that, it endangers my inheritance with my family. And so, in the Near East culture, everything's looking good for Boaz. He says, fine, if you don't buy the land and take Ruth, I'm going to redeem them. They swap sandals, and the deal's over. Okay? Who knows how this happens? They take off a sandal, and they give each other a sandal. And we're back to the feet theme, but these sandals represented a contract. So he gives him a sandal, and the contract has been made. He will redeem Ruth and Naomi. And he will marry Ruth. All right? He goes to the gate at the beginning of chapter 4. Conclusion of chapter 4. The deal is done. Then Boaz, in verse 9, said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon, which were before Elimelech. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today. So here's Boaz redeeming Ruth. You think, well, isn't that neat? Isn't that a great story? I mean, that's totally cool. Here's a daughter-in-law who loves her mother-in-law. They lose everything. She comes back to a foreign country. She clearly places her allegiance and her confidence in Yahweh God, the God of Israel. She has turned her back on her gods and her people to follow Naomi's God, the one true living God, and to be with Naomi's people. And here she finds a husband. He's a wealthy guy. This is going to be a great life. They live together, right? In the Hallmark movie, that's the end of the story. That's it. And we, you know, feel warm and fuzzy and wipe the tear away. And we say, okay, great. Good movie. Good story. Good book. But there's a kicker to this. And it's at the end. Now look at verse 18 of chapter 4. Now, these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron. And to Hezron was born Ram. And to Ram, Amminadab. And to Amminadab was born Nahshon. And to Nahshon, Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz was born Obed. So Obed was the son of Boaz and Ruth, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse was born David. So here's the miracle of providence. God was orchestrating through suffering, through difficult times, through disobedience even, he was orchestrating through all the decisions and all the events of life, he was orchestrating the line of King David. That is the message of Ruth. God's providence was at work through common people, just like you and me, to orchestrate and to bring about his plan, which was the birth of King David. Now you know, because you're biblically astute, that we should then turn to Matthew chapter 1 to conclude this morning. Okay? Matthew chapter 1. Verse 5. Matthew 1, 5. And we're done. Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. Interesting fact. Boaz, on the other hand, was the father of Obed by Ruth. And Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David, the king. You say, well, that's interesting. That just says the same thing we just read. That's right. And whose genealogy is this? Jesus. This is the genealogy of our Messiah, of our Savior, of our Redeemer in an eternal sense. The book of Ruth is not just a love story. The book of Ruth is a testimony to God's providence in using common people and common events, both good and bad, difficult and easy, wealth and poverty, to bring about and orchestrate your salvation and my salvation through our Messiah. that's powerful. That's the truth of this book of the Bible. You should never read it again without thinking of Jesus Christ. Because He, like every other book of the Bible, is the end of the book of Ruth. God was bringing a Savior to sinners. So, conclusion. God is at work in every life represented here today. God can and will use your life to accomplish His divine purposes. And then in turn, you and I should fall on our faces in worship and live lives of obedience to a God who rules the events of history. There's only one response to a God who can orchestrate all history and all decisions and all events to create and to generate and to bring about His will. There's only one response to that. The only one right response to that, and that is humility before Him and worship and adoration and allegiance to Him. And you may be sitting here today and you think, I don't think I like this God. I don't like a God who brings about His will. I want to live life by my will. I don't like a God who orchestrates the events of history to accomplish His end. I want to orchestrate the events of my life to my end. And that's sin. And you're going to deal with it the rest of your life. And I deal with it every day of my life. Constant battle between me being on the throne of my life or recognizing in humility that God is on the throne of my life and living my life in submission to Him, knowing that He is working through His providence to accomplish His end. All right? That's the book of Ruth. And I trust it's an encouragement to you. It should be, because it declares the miracle of God's providence. All right? Father, thank You so much for Your truth. Thank You for its clarity, its simplicity. Thank You for this awesome story of love and affection and human kindness and generosity and marriage and happiness and the kind of story that we like to read where it starts out rough and it ends really good. And yet, Father, thank You for this story, because this story in its history declares that You are a sovereign God who reigns over everything that You've created. And that You use common people, common events, to accomplish Your divine purpose. Thank You for our Savior, Jesus Christ, who flows directly out of the line of Boaz and Ruth. We praise You. We bow before You. We humble ourselves before You, as we've sung this morning already, in adoration and recognition that You alone are the God of providence, and You alone are worthy of our praise. We ask all this because of our Savior, who has rescued us, who has redeemed us from a life of sin to a life of obedience to You and an eternity with You in heaven. We ask it in His name. Amen.